This is The Guardian.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe. Das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. This is a special on FIFA's decision to award the 2034 World Cup to Saudi Arabia. What appeared to be a fait accompli for years was rubber stamped on a Zoom call last week. Delegates applauding it through like it was some kind of COVID game show. Questions then. So how transparent was the bidding process? Why did Saudi Arabia want the World Cup? And why were FIFA and Gianni Infantino hell-bent on them getting it? How have FAs around the world reacted? What can they do? Much like Qatar, there are big questions over the rights of migrant workers, given the amount of stadia and infrastructure planned, including building a Czechs Notes new stadium 350 metres above the ground in a city that doesn't exist yet. The rights of women and LGBTQ plus community also need serious consideration. Saudi Arabia does have a strong football culture. Many fans from the Middle East and Asia love the Qatar World Cup. How should we face the accusations of being Eurocentric or just being biased Westerners when we discuss all the above issues? This is The Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Nick Ames, who's written extensively on the Saudi bid in the Qatar World Cup before that. Hey, Nick.
Hello, Max.
Philippe Auclair, Football Weekly's moral conscience. Bonjour, ça va?
Ça va très bien, Max. Merci.
And a friend of the pod, Lina Al-Hathloul, Saudi human rights activist, who you may remember we talked about when Saudi Arabia were going to buy Newcastle, about her sister who was imprisoned by the Saudi regime, also fighting for women's rights. Lina, thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
Hi, Max. Thank you so much. I'm good.
Let's begin with the process. FIFA boss Gianni Infantino announced the decision to award the tournament to Saudi Arabia in that Zoom meeting I mentioned in the intro. This is how it sounded.
And last but not least, it is a great pleasure that I can confirm that the host of the FIFA World Cup 2034 will be Saudi Arabia. Mabruk. Mabruk to our friends in Riyadh.
The bidding was officially opened on the 6th of October 2023. It gave prospective countries just 25 days to get a bid together, something that usually takes months, and that Saudi Arabia had been prepping for some time. Apart from that bidding process, no confederation that has hosted the World Cup can host the following two, which meant 2034 had to go to Asia or Oceania. And that left us with the slim hope that Australia might scramble a bid at the 11th hour. But in reality, the process had been, it feels, gamed to ensure that Saudi Arabia were the sole bidder. Philippe, what do you make of the process?
Oh, the process was a shocker because, in fact, I mean, you refer to the principle of rotation between confederations. And obviously, one big problem for having a Saudi World Cup was the fact that you had other confederations which qualified, and notably UEFA, CONMEBOL and CAF. So Europe, South America and Africa. And the decision which basically made sure that Saudi Arabia would get the 2034 World Cup was when FIFA announced there would be one only unique candidacy for the 2030 World Cup, which would be the joint Spain, Portugal, and Morocco bid. So that put two confederations out of the running for 2034, i.e. UEFA, Spain and Portugal, and Africa, CAF, because of Morocco. And then there was something very clever, let's put it that way, which happened, which is that FIFA decided, because it was the tournament that would be the 100th anniversary of the first World Cup, which took place in Uruguay. So a few games were delocalized, so to speak, three games indeed, and were given, the first three games, to South America, to Uruguay, Argentina, and Paraguay, if I'm not mistaken, Chile being left aside. But that meant that CONMEBOL, South America, basically received some games and therefore was considered to have hosted, you know, little rabbit ears here, to have hosted a World Cup, which left only Asia and Oceania to compete. Oceania doesn't have the means to welcome a 48-team World Cup because this would be a 48-team World Cup. So this left Australia, which at one point was thinking of giving... to having a bid, a joint bid with Singapore. The Asian Confederation moved in very quickly and said, well, no, we have one candidate, and this candidate is Saudi Arabia. Singapore, I think, were the first to say, no, we're not part, we're not going to bid against our brothers. And Australia, who had in mind to get the 2026 Women's Asian Cup and perhaps an edition of the Club World Cup, FIFA Club World Cup as well, decided to withdraw. So therefore, from that moment on, we knew that Saudi Arabia would get 2034. I mean, one thing which is quite extraordinary is that the Saudi declared their interest in hosting the 2034 World Cup only 81 minutes, Max, after the decision of FIFA to award the 2030 World Cup to Spain, Portugal, and Morocco. I mean, it had been a stitch up. We all knew this was going to happen. And I think the only thing which surprised us was the brazenness of the process.
Nick, the Zoom presentation was bizarre, wasn't it? Sort of like an enormous online celebrity squares. What did you make of that? And why do you think it was just done online like that?
Yeah, you had different FA heads in their cars in some situations, just sort of watching on with their headphones in. It was a complete parody of what due process or scrutiny should be, and just something very concerning. And we can come on to the sort of responsibility of individual FAs, you know, to have said or done something. But I spoke to one or two of them European based as well beforehand, and I'm saying, look, you can't be happy with how this is going to come across over Zoom, a vote through acclamation, a fait accompli. As we have said, you can't really be happy with this process, even though I know you're going to nod it through. And the answer from a couple of these people was, no, we're really not happy. A few of us are really unhappy about how this is going down, but we're going to do it anyway. And which made the whole thing so hollow and vacuous to watch. And yeah, total lack of scrutiny, which is a theme of modern day FIFA. I think they are very happy to avoid questions broadly from the media and people who might put, you know, this bid and other such things under the microscope, and convening people in a place and in a room together where media and other organizations might be able to get in front of them and corner them, and whether on or off the record, ask questions, get words from them, you know, it's not convenient for them now. So doing it online under the sort of husk of sustainability, we're saving on flights, this, that, and the other, was an absolute sham, and even more of a sham knowing that a lot of these people were waving, applauding, thumbs up, whatever, this whole farce through without believing in it for one moment, which I think is one of the most depressing things about all this.
We sort of know why Saudi Arabia want to host the World Cup. Is this a sign then that they feel that what they've done in sport so far has achieved its purpose?
The whole procedure has been engineered for Saudi Arabia to have an undemocratic win. Is really, I mean, it's just so shocking. And I mean, I'm not surprised, but I'm just surprised that everyone is not able to stop it. The Saudi authorities really are very proud of how this went. I mean, they're telling the world, this is how we rule, and we've really managed to impose our way of seeing things, our way of ruling, and you know, our policies, without anyone being able to say anything. And this is where I thought, okay, it's the beginning of a new era, really. Going back to your question, I think that you know, the premise of your question is to say that Saudi Arabia maybe has as a main goal when investing in sport to whitewash its human rights record or to rebrand itself. I tend to say that Saudi Arabia, as in the undemocratic and brutal the authorities are, I think that there is also a soft power strategy. And it's not necessarily about rebranding itself or... But what we see is the consequences of everyone's silence is that Saudi Arabia really managed to embolden itself and cover up everything that's happening in the country. And it created a bubble that is really far, far, far from the reality of what people live in Saudi Arabia. I mean, Saudi Arabia, maybe just as a reminder, since Mohammed bin Salman came to power in 2016, more or less, it has turned into a police state, meaning that the beginning of the institutions that we've had have been completely dismantled. Mohammed bin Salman rules the country with a very strong, firm arm, and no one can contest anything he says. And sports, of course, plays a very important role in that. And the PIF specifically, I think, I mean, I invite everyone to read the new Human Rights Watch report called The Man Who Bought the World. And it really shows you how our sovereign fund has been completely restructured in order for Mohammed bin Salman to have complete power over that. And so to remind everyone, what is Saudi Arabia today? Saudi Arabia is a police state that is governed by Mohammed bin Salman himself, where people can get forcibly disappeared for tweets, where women have been tortured in prison, where this year, actually, we have broken the record of the number of executions, and where free speech has been completely forbidden, or you can get arrested for saying barely anything, and you don't have any clear red lines. Given that everyone has accepted Saudi money unconditionally, it leads to whitewashing. Because no one speaks about the reality on the ground, because no one really wants to take the risk to speak about Saudi abuses, because everyone sees interest in accepting Saudi money, then what this leads to, Mohammed bin Salman being empowered, this leads to the Saudi people's reality being veiled, covered, and then it also, you know, in the long term, will have an effect on the rule of law for everyone in general. When I said that it's about the rule of law, it's about democratic principles, it's about, you know, fundamental freedoms that no one really seems to understand that they have the privilege of living. There's a UK, a British journalist who has been forbidden from entering a boxing match in the UK because he criticized the Saudi regime. And that boxing match was hosted and funded by the Saudi regime. So the extent to which the Saudi government is willing to go to silence people, to muzzle people, goes far beyond the Saudi borders. So this is where it gets really dangerous. Saudi Arabia shows everyone that they do not respect any kind of fundamental freedoms, and that they don't care about their image anymore because everyone has accepted money unconditionally. So again, it's not necessarily only about how Saudi people are suffering today. It's really about accepting for the rule of law to be dismantled through the investment of sports.
Philippe, why do FIFA / Gianni Infantino want Saudi Arabia to have it? Is that just purely money?
Yes, absolutely. I don't see any other reason or purpose for that. I think it's a meeting of minds when it comes to the ambitions of one country and or one regime rather than one country and one organization. The links between FIFA and Saudi Arabia are extremely deep. But what is very interesting is how quickly it's happened, because you will remember that FIFA's favorite partner was Qatar up until the 2022 World Cup. And then it moved to Saudi, which of course is a bit of a, when you know a bit about geopolitics, Qatar and Saudi Arabia perhaps being not the best of friends is an interesting, shall we say, change of focus. But you saw another example for the Club World Cup, which is happening in 2025, the extended Club World Cup taking place in the US in June and July. FIFA was really struggling to get, and is really struggling to get, anybody interested in that. It just so happens that the broadcasting rights have been given to DAZN or DAZN. I mean, people say it differently in different countries. And who is going to invest $1 billion into DAZN? It's Saudi Arabia. And you could carry on like this. Who is the biggest sponsor to have arrived on FIFA's doorstep recently? Saudi Aramco, of course, which is the oil producer, which happens, by the way, to be where a certain Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who is also the president of Newcastle, plays a very big role in there, as he plays a very big role in PIF. There's one thing I would like to add to that, because we shouldn't forget that this is something that the Saudi regime has been implicated in, not just over the last 6 months or 2 years. There's something which coincides with the way that MBS has taken over power. You will remember the 2017 bloodless coup, basically. And since then, you've had people like Yasser Al-Misrael, who is the president of the Saudi Arabia Football Federation, traveling around the world, signing memorandums of understanding with local football federations and confederations, even 48 in total, and which is exactly an illustration of what Lina was talking about, that you make people dependent on your money, and therefore afterwards nobody dares say anything against you. So some federations, all their money comes from FIFA. FIFA wants money from the Saudis. It's a kind of vicious circle which is established here. At the same time, perhaps for these countries which are not directly dependent on FIFA money, what you use sponsorship. There was a recent report by Play the Game, you know, the Danish organization, which identified 910 sponsorships, of which 194 were in football. So you feed money into the system, the sports system, and in football in particular, and you make people, in a way, dependent on you for their for their financing. And FIFA does want to make more and more and more money. Where's the money going to come from? Well, you've got a very willing customer here, which is Saudi Arabia. Let's go for them. It's a very long answer to come back to the very first word of my response, which is yes, from FIFA's angle and from the football world and from the sports world at large, it's money.
I think this is a great discussion to have and a great podcast to do, but I'm already getting a sense of deja vu. Harking back to discussions we had in the build-up to Qatar and in the build-up to the World Cup in Saudi Arabia, there'll be talk like this discussion we're having here about concerns over human rights abuses, LGBT plus rights, the weather, the football calendar, migrant workers, the treatment of women. But I'm just worried that that's all it will be. It will be talk. And we'll still end up, if we're still kicking around in 10 years' time, watching that World Cup in Saudi Arabia, enjoying it and reporting on it. And the audience, the Football Weekly audience, I suspect we're already preaching to the choir. They already agree with us. So I just wonder what we're doing here, apart from sort of ticking a box to say, oh, well, we've made our feelings clear. I'm not sure what else can be achieved.
What we do have here is a 10-year run-up to hold feet to the fire. I think, you know, a lot of The Guardian's most important reporting pre-Qatar, through the brilliant Pete Patterson, who literally followed coffins of workers back to Nepal to understand causes of death and how that has happened. It went countless times. I think we began most of that work from memory around 2013. So we've got 10 years now to ensure that, you know, In some ways, it's making the best of a shocking situation, but we've got a long time to be able to, you know, as media and as fans and as stakeholders in football, bring people together to work out how best to interrogate what is going on. And 10 years, it is a long time. The world can change pretty quickly. Football changes all the time. What will international football look like then? So I think with 10 years, we've got time to build quite a lot of momentum up in this discussion. I know that's slightly abstract, but it is a long time to be able to, you know, put forces behind it.
I mean, we have 10 years, as has been said. And us Saudis, we don't have the privilege to say that it's only a ticking box game. We have to take every opportunity to speak about what's happening in our country. I mean, for us, it's not just speaking about women's rights or LGBT rights or, you know, any kind of minority group that are known to be repressed, just as a generality. It's about building up to that World Cup with concrete demands, and our political prisoners are not just collateral damages to greedy ambitions or to such events. For us, they are a priority, and we do hope that, or I do hope that, by, you know, participating in such a podcast, people will at least get to know some of our political prisoners and will call for the release of some of them. I mean, the Saudi authorities have not allowed any human rights organization on the ground since Mohammed bin Salman came to power. So I do hope that by 2034, at least some human rights organizations will be able to enter the country, document, advocate, visit political prisoners, you know, ask for their release. Some have been forcibly disappeared for years now. Since 2018, Abdurrahman Asadhan has been forcibly disappeared. So I do hope that by speaking about them, at least we will know about their whereabouts. I think that, you know, it's not really, I think we don't have the privilege, and we should not just think that it's nonsense discussions, you know, and we have to have clear benchmarks on how the discussion goes. And I'll just repeat that our political prisoners should be a priority in these discussions, and you should all also be naming them when speaking about Saudi Arabia.
And let's do that in part two.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe, das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly, and let's talk about human rights. And that does include women's rights, LGBTQ plus rights, workers and migrant workers' rights as well. And Lena, as you said, political prisoners. So as you say, we want to talk about them. Tell us about them.
Yeah, just maybe to start, I would say that women's rights, migrant workers' rights, LGBTQ rights, all of that are secondary. Because first, what we have to do is be able to speak in Saudi Arabia, be able to be human rights defenders. And as long as people get imprisoned for demanding their basic rights, then we cannot speak about any other minorities. And so first, the priority is to release all political prisoners, including those who have been arrested and sentenced for tweeting. I mean, one case is Salma al-Shihab. Salma al-Shihab was sentenced to 27 years in prison. She just went on vacation in Saudi Arabia to visit her family, and they saw tweets of her where she was standing in solidarity with my sister. She is still in prison. Another case is Manah al-Ratibi, sentenced to 11 years for tweeting under feminist hashtags and for not wearing a abaya, the black clothing. So our prisons are full of people who have dared to speak their mind and who have advocated for a better country. The second thing that has to be known is, again, as I said, human rights organizations are not allowed on the ground. Trials are held behind closed doors. Executions are held behind closed doors. So we don't know what's happening in the country. And in order to get information, us as human rights organizations, people have to take the risk either to flee the country with court documents and show them to us, or take the risk to speak inside. And we've lost so many of our sources who are now probably in prison. So it's a complete police state where, you know, everyone has been muzzled, and this has to be understood. Now going to minorities or groups' rights. When we speak about women's rights, I think that people in 2034, when people will go, they won't see the problem, because Saudi Arabia really has managed to create a bubble inside the country where tourists and Western people mostly cannot see the violations. So, for example, they've allowed women to drive. But no one could see that the women who have been leading the fight of women to drive were actually imprisoned, forcibly disappeared, and brutally tortured. Another example is that, you know, you can see women now in cafes, and, you know, you have mixed places, and women mostly can wear what they want. But again, it's not institutional. A policeman can consider a woman as being indecent and arrest her for that. And most of the women who get arrested for being indecent, quote unquote, are women from families that do not have the protection of their families, because you still have the male guardianship system. As a woman, you are under the good will of your male guardian, who's your father or your husband. So, you know, Western people will be able to wear what they want in Saudi Arabia and not know that some women actually get arrested, imprisoned, and sentenced to decades in prison for, you know, believing that they can wear freely. Again, I think that also for LGBTQ people going to Saudi Arabia, they won't have any issue. And this is really, I'm not saying that it's problematic that they'll they'll be able to be free in Saudi Arabia. What I'm saying is that the double standards, you know, Saudi people get arrested for that, but for Saudi Arabia to get investment, and because they know that it's a priority for Western people, then they would allow Western people to, you know, to enjoy total freedom in Saudi Arabia, while the Saudi people live a different reality. So probably people will go back, you know, after 2034, saying that everything they heard about Saudi is wrong, and that, you know, they were able to enjoy it fully and all of that. But no one really sees what's happening in the country to locals, to residents, to citizens. And this is where it's problematic, because, you know, you also, you know, you have women. I mean, Georgina Cristiano's girlfriend is posts her pictures of herself in bikinis. I mean, no Saudi woman could do that without getting arrested. And so they've really created a bubble for investments for Western people to see, while Saudi Arabia has not foundationally changed. I don't know, you know, how to really show you the dark and brutal reality of what the Saudis live, but it's not a happy one.
Gianni Infantino has said in the past, "We are, of course, aware of critics and fears. I fully trust our hosts to address all open points, and I fully expect them to deliver tournaments that meet the world's expectations. This is what we expect and look forward to: social improvements, positive human rights impacts. The world will be watching, and it is positive that the unique spotlight of the World Cup is on what can and should be improved so that this can be addressed effectively and we can have real and lasting change." Barry.
Very interesting that Lena says that, actually, because during the World Cup of Qatar, you would occasionally see social media posts or indeed articles from football writers who sort of went, "Well, I went for a jog at 6 o'clock in the morning and I didn't see anyone working in conditions hotter than the sun, and any locals I encountered were smiling and happy, so everything must be okay. And even now we're seeing some UK journalists, and it may well be happening in other countries, who look like they're already getting their ducks in a row ahead of Saudi Arabia 2034, going, well, maybe it's not as sinister and bleak as it seems. Let's maybe give it a chance. It's quite depressing to see that happening.
Nick, can we talk about workers' rights and migrant workers as well? You've written about the infrastructure, because, you know, Saudi Arabia does have a football culture, which we'll get to. You know, there are stadia there, but they are going to build a lot, and that will involve a lot of, and a whole city that they're planning on building, and that will involve a lot of migrant workers.
A big number to remember at this point is 21,000, which is the number of, I think it's Nepali, Indian and Bangladeshi workers that are already reported to have died in Saudi Arabia since its Grand Vision 2030 plan was launched, I think, eight years or so ago. So, look, there is already reportedly a lot of blood on the country's hands from this big rebuild it's doing. And as we know, I mean, laughably, given the score that FIFA gave Saudi's bid in its feasibility report.
Yeah, they were given 419.8 out of 500, which is the same score for stadia in the USA, even though those stadia in the USA almost all exist.
Which is crazy. It's like reviewing a restaurant but showing up and they've actually got nothing on the menu yet. It's mad. And there's always going to be a bit of a leap of faith with such documents, obviously, because work has to be carried out. But this was egregious. So you've got most of the stadiums not yet built, but very lavishly planned. A lot of it by companies with at least offices or presences in the UK, by the way. You've got an entire city, NEOM, which, if listeners haven't heard about it, NEOM, N-E-O-M, it's well worth looking up and seeing what the extravagant plan for a long, very thin line raised, I think, 300 metres above the ground, supposedly going for about 110 kilometres, looks like. I think plans for that have already had to be scaled back to some extent. And this is going to take a lot of work. It's going to take tens and hundreds of thousands of workers. It is already. And we've seen the human cost in Qatar. That's been written about at length. We've seen how reparations to those workers, by the way, have not been made by FIFA. We see no guarantee that will be made this time at all. And we don't see any obvious concrete pledge or fix that this is not going to happen again. Workers working in really bleak, searingly hot conditions, working far longer hours than they should, often physically unprepared for this kind of work as well. There's just nobody who can guarantee you that tens of thousands of people are not going to die in an adjacent way to the construction of this tournament. And even during it, I mean, I don't know if this is a directly related point or not, but a few hours after the Argentina versus Netherlands World Cup quarterfinal in Doha, a Kenyan worker died falling off a stadium, off Lusail Stadium. And it was written about, but not seen as a huge, huge deal. And you know, I don't think it's appropriate to go into reasons or causes or anything like that, but you can look at that and make your own conclusions. This was happening in Qatar in front of our eyes. That is happening in front of our eyes on our watch. And there's absolutely no mechanism that I have seen that convinces me that it won't happen again.
Saudi Arabia says it maintains robust regulations and standards to safeguard workers' rights and that thorough investigations are conducted into all workplace incidents. Suggestions of negligence or lack of transparency are unfounded, it added. Lena, you wanted to come in.
So basically, NEOM, when MBS talks about NEOM, he says that it's a new megacity project that is built on virgin lands, that no one was living there and so forth and so on. But actually, you have villages where people have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they have been brutally displaced. And the ones who have refused to leave their houses were actually arrested, prosecuted, and imprisoned. Five are on death row for having refused to leave their houses. So the Saudis are actually going to have their heads cut because they refuse to leave their houses to make a way for a city that will be hosting the World Cup. It goes, you know, it's as horrible as that. And I think that it has to be reminded to everyone. And of course, we also monitored a migrant worker's death while working on NEOM. And the issue, again, is about the opacity and the lack of transparency in all of these procedures. The brother has contacted us, and he has no way to find out how his brother died. And when the Saudi authorities respond saying that everything has been investigated and there are no... that all deaths are normal, or however they say that. The main question is, why are not independent monitors allowed on the ground? Why is it always the Saudi authorities investigating? Why is it always the Saudi authorities giving the response? So allow the UN special rapporteurs to be on the ground, allow human rights organizations to document things. And then we might say that there is, you know, the beginning of transparency, and maybe we might trust the Saudi authorities' responses. But as long as everything is closed to independent monitors, then we cannot say that anything said by the Saudi authorities can be trusted, really.
All right, that will do for part two. And part three, we'll talk about the responsibility of FAs, the responsibility of fans, and any other business as well.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung. Und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe. Das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden, guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. A question from Pepsi that says, I can't quite decide if I have a right to be annoyed about Saudi hosting the World Cup or whether I'm being an arrogant Westerner. It seems slightly different from Qatar, as at least Saudi have some footballing World Cup history. He says, and I assume more infrastructure to host the competition than Qatar did. We covered how much work they have to do on that. But I still feel uneasy about it with the whole sports washing thing. Am I correct too? In theory, Saudi should have the same right to host as the USA, so why does it feel different? And Lena, there is a very frequent criticism that we will get after this podcast, that when we bring up these issues, we might call for boycotts, but we don't boycott ourselves. The newspaper doesn't boycott it. Once the football starts, we watch the games. Once the World Cup finishes, we forget about it. And a lot of that is practical, right? The news cycle moves on, the season starts. But I wonder what you think is the correct response to the criticism. In many ways, also the criticism that it's a kind of anti-Arab thing that we are doing. This is it is racist to talk about this.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and I think it's very timely, and we need to speak about this. When we criticize the Saudi authorities on their human rights abuses, it's because the Saudi people cannot speak for themselves. And when we say that, you know, we should not be speaking about Saudi Arabia because it's a different culture, it's a different tradition, and all of this, what we have to be reminded that the Saudi people live under a brutal dictatorship. That people cannot, I mean, give me one example, just one example of one person who has said anything close to criticism of the Saudi authorities or the Saudi regime that are not in prison. Everyone is in prison. Our prisons are full. So the Saudi authorities have really managed to to gaslight everyone for criticizing their human rights abuses. And I always give this example. So what is Saudi culture? What is Saudi tradition? I mean, human rights are for everyone. When we say that we should not respect, we should respect the Saudis because it's a different tradition or different culture. I mean, it's not part of our culture to be repressive. It's not part of our culture, not to respect women. It's not part of our culture. All we cannot say that we have a culture when people have not been able to elaborate and develop this culture. It's always a state imposed one. And I always give this example to really illustrate what I want to say. So the Saudi authorities, when women were not allowed to drive, they would always say, "Yeah, but it's the Saudi people's culture. People are not ready for women to drive." And that, you know, the majority of the Saudis are not ready for women to drive. And then all of a sudden, MBS arrives and he allows women to drive. And all of a sudden, everyone repeats the same state-sponsored narrative that, oh, wow, 80% of the people are happy about MBS because he finally allowed women to drive. So who are these Saudis? You know, are they the ones who have been, you know, for years not been okay with women driving? Or are these 80% very happy of women now being able to drive and the opening of the country? So, you know, like saying that you don't want to engage with Saudi Arabia or, you know, really condemn the human rights abuses because it's racist or whatever, it does not make any sense. I mean, you would be seen less racist talking about our political prisoners, saying that MBS does not actually represent Saudi Arabia, when you stay silent and accept Saudi money and accept to go to Saudi Arabia, you're only green lighting the policies of MBS and giving us even more a harder time advocating for our fundamental freedoms. So there is nothing racist about saying that Saudi Arabia is problematic. It is MBS. It's not the Saudis. It's not the Saudi state. It's MBS himself, really.
And Lina, following up on what you just said, the money goes to lots of different places. Lots of people, as we've established, you know, are now rely on this money. What do you say to people who choose to take money from the Saudi state, be it a footballer or a broadcaster or you know, someone who's going to build a stadium or whatever? I mean, I'm fascinated to know.
I don't want Saudi Arabia to be boycotted. I mean, I don't want it to be embargoed. I don't want sanctions. I don't want all of that. I mean, my people deserve life. They deserve also to enjoy everything everyone else enjoys. The only issue is that when we accept Saudi money, we usually do it unconditionally. So everyone telling me that, you know, Lina, you're being too harsh and that, you know, you have to build bridges and Saudi has to open up to the world in order to change, which is completely true. But I have not seen one person accept Saudi money and willing to raise their voice on what's happening. I have not seen one person accept Saudi money and at the same time talk about our political prisoners. So what we see is that Saudi money actually is always conditioned to silence. And this is where it's problematic. So if you do accept Saudi money and in exchange, you know, allow yourself to be silenced in face of all of that, then you're really being complicit. It's really feeding a monster that will one day be unstoppable.
A very important part of this is that the criticism should also be directed at the Western companies. And that's not orientalizing that, to say that the building constructors, to say that the people who are providing their know-how, their expertise to the building of those stadiums and this infrastructure are mostly coming from Western countries. So those companies have got to be put in front of their own responsibilities. And it's whataboutery. I mean, it always ends up with whataboutery. Why are you not talking about the US? Well, Max, we will be talking about the US, won't we? And we'll be talking about Mexico and Canada. And we'll be talking about Morocco, for example. I've never quite understood this argument, I must say, because, again, we've said it again and again, and I think Nick can talk about this, but we could enjoy the fact that Saudi Arabia beat Argentina and Qatar. And we did. Because that team represents not the regime, but the Saudi people. And it was, I would imagine, a huge explosion of joy from everybody there, and genuine joy, sporting joy, which should be celebrated. There is no contradiction in those two. It's this strange ambivalence that we have to have with sport in the 21st century, when the interests of so many different people and such different interests are intertwined to such an extent that we find ourselves saying, should I celebrate this goal by a Saudi player? Well, of course you should. Should I criticize the Saudi regime? Well, of course you should. Should I criticize the companies which are building the stadium? Of course you should. Should you criticize those reporters who are starting, we won't name names, but who are starting already to be nuanced, as they call it, about what is going on? Should we be also, I mean, maybe we can touch on that as well, be completely blind to the environmental impact of this World Cup, which is another aspect of it, which is very problematic, and it's which Western companies have got a big, big role to play. Whichever way you look at it, you're trying to find ways to silence yourself. And by silencing yourself, you're causing harm to the people who are suffering.
Lena spoke very eloquently there about people who take Saudi money and then stay silent, but a lot of them don't stay silent. Some of them, and I'm looking at boxing here, actively become cheerleaders for the Saudi regime, and that's very worrying. And if boxing is doing that, I certainly can see football following suit.
It is worth saying the Norwegian Football Federation president has spoken up. The only person in any footballing authority attempting to hold Infantino and FIFA to account, Lisa Klaveness. The Norwegian FA have refused to endorse the bid. The Swiss FA did endorse the bid but called for independent human rights monitoring. The English FA chose not to abstain or vote against. Germany's National Football Association announced it would vote in favour of both the Saudi Arabia bid and the multi-nation bid for 2030. What do we make? It feels, Nick, brave of the Norwegian FA, especially to do it alone.
Yeah, they have a track record of, you know, taking the right kind of stand. Lisa Klaveness is definitely not unhappy to ruffle feathers where they need to be ruffled, and I think those people expect it of her as well. So I don't think it was a surprise to too many people who've studied these things closely that it was Norway who came out and, you know, went on record and, you know, asked for their objections to be read out. I think it was by Infantino's number two, Mattias Grafström, in the sham that happened last week. So I think the fact it was Norway themselves is no big surprise. But the really depressing thing is that it was just them and a bit of Switzerland. And it goes back to what I said at the top, which was that there were a lot of people doing this who knew that what they were doing or what they were nodding through was not being done with good process or even with great intentions. The vast majority of FAs kept quiet, and it is a disgrace for many, many reasons, and there's a lot of very compromised people in football now.
I suppose to counter that, you'd say, what can we expect of FAs? You know, our government is there trying to do, you know, big fight business over there. Like, do we hold our FAs to a higher account than them?
Of course. There's one thing that governments are forced to have real politic. They have no choice but to engage with everybody. Channels are open even to your worst enemies. That's the fact of life. It's always been like this. It'll always be like this. This is different. This is a decision taken by sport, by football in this particular case, to choose that particular country, that particular regime. And in complete, ignoring every single rule of transparency and accountability, this is completely different. I mean, we cannot, the argument will go, oh, well, look, like Sir Keir Starmer met with a Saudi representative or a minister and so forth. Well, so therefore, you know, it's quite normal if our sporting organizations want to engage with the Saudis. Well, no, it's not. It's not at all. It's especially not at all since FIFA is supposed to be an association of associations. And it no longer is the case. And in some cases, you can understand why some countries which entirely depend on FIFA's largesse to survive in terms of football administration, that is, will not bite the hand that feeds them. It's not particularly glorious or something to take pride in, but you can understand it. In the case of the FA, for example, that there's been a complete lack of responsibility here. It's just that some weasel words were said. I think there was a kind of statement in which they said that they had met with the Saudi organized or bidding committee, and that assurances had been given, and that was okay. That's as far as it went. These federations, these member associations, do not depend on FIFA's money to survive. The FA is rich, wealthy. The French FA is exactly the same, but they still went along with it because they're thinking beyond that. Okay, I want to be in FIFA's good books because I might want to buy for the 2038 World Cup, for example, something, you know, things like that. And but this is completely different from, you know, governments having to deal with each other, because you cannot live in isolation. You know, you cannot live in isolation.
There is a real football culture in Saudi. So people in Saudi Arabia will love the World Cup when it happens. People in the Middle East and Asia love the World Cup in Qatar. Do you think we should boycott it? Do you think, what should people listening to this do?
It's a very difficult question. I mean, I am abroad and I don't think I should prevent my people from anything I would be enjoying here. The thing is, I do hope that with people engaging, whether going to Saudi or watching it here or commenting on it online, would have the victims of the Saudi regime in their mind. And one thing to do is really, I mean, do not boycott if you don't want to boycott. But if you boycott, don't say it's me. if you do watch it, please, I mean, talk about my sister. You know, ask why Lujain is still on a travel ban. I mean, you'll be going to Saudi Arabia in 2034, not knowing that maybe the people next to you are on a travel ban, not being able to leave the country because they've tweeted something critical of the regime. So you do not, you know, you cannot just go enjoy the freedoms that have been granted by MBS to you and just to leave and then applaud what MBS has done without, you know, giving any kind of word or, you know, sentiment to the people inside. So tweet about the victims of the regime, ask for the end of the executions. I promise you, it does bring change, and the Saudi authorities feel obliged to take responsibility in some of the cases. So do not forget us, and do not think that the Saudi authorities are the Saudi people. And because there is a splashy event in Saudi Arabia, does not mean that the Saudis are enjoying a daily life with full freedom. Again, our political prisoners should be a priority during the next 10 years.
And just to a point that was made then and earlier about the importance of putting this event under the microscope and the real world consequences if we don't. I look back at Russia 2018, which, with some very honourable exceptions, by the way, was, I think, a bit of a failure in journalism. And I count myself in this, by the way, as well, in terms of going out there, not really acknowledging enough what was already happening and had already been happening from Putin in Crimea and the Donbass, and going out there and basically reporting on and enjoying the football and not really holding or seeing what was about to come and holding it to scrutiny. Now, we all know what has happened since then, and we all know that if you are European and other parts of the world too, what has happened since then, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, has directly affected you in some way. And I'm not saying that, you know, more extensive reporting around the World Cup would have stopped that, but it could have made a difference. It could definitely have caused a bit more outcry, a bit more publicity, a bit more context behind why this World Cup was being held and why it was important to Putin and Russia. So I think maybe the same applies here. And I think hopefully as media, we're a bit more prepared this time, especially after Qatar, to be able to have a run-up and do this properly. I remember the day after the final in Qatar, I'd covered the Messi and Mbappe final, fantastic game, everyone's high on football. But the next day I went to a workers' camp just about 20 miles away, just outside Doha, wrote about it. And I can remember every second of that day. I can remember barely anything about what happened the day before in the final. Genuinely, I'm not exaggerating. I'm not kidding. Wonderful, best World Cup final ever. But I can tell you every single word that those guys said to me the next day. And that has stuck with me very much. And I think personally, and I think collectively, we're hopefully a bit better prepared now after the lessons of the last two World Cups to be able to do this properly as media and as a football community.
Lena, final word from you, please.
Maybe just to say, so I can't go to Saudi Arabia now because it's too risky. And many of the diaspora cannot go back either. And the idea is to build up a coalition of fans during the next 10 years who would be willing to take responsibility and engage with us and create a kind of a safe circle where they would be in engaging with us and flying to Saudi Arabia with us in 10 years. So anyone, you know, thinking of going to Saudi in 10 years for the 2034 World Cup and willing also to take responsibility and helping us go back home, I'm happy to engage with you directly. Please feel free to reach out to us and we can work all together.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much, everyone, for doing this. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Thanks, Baz.
Thank you.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Max.
And especially, Lena, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Max. Thanks, everyone.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.